Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and it's been about a month and a half since we finished up our top 100 movies of all time. Each of us counted down from 100 to 1, so if you haven't checked that out, check it out. Of course, when we were doing that, that's our favorite 100 movies, and that could be from any time, any place, anywhere, as John proved with movies like Battleship Potemkin, and then making us all watch Columbus, which I still have not forgiven him for, even though everybody loves that movie except me. But we're going to get a little bit more mainstream with this series. And this series, we were trying to figure out, is there anything we can do that's two movies? Because that's what we had a lot of fun doing originally. We're doing two movies. It was my favorite. It was John's favorite. And we'd kind of count our way down through the top 100. If you haven't checked it out, it's still on the YouTube channel for the specialists. It's not hidden. I have the playlist up there as one of our top playlists. So that's good. But we couldn't figure out what to do with this. So we said we wanted to do like newer movies, because what I found I was doing was watching nothing but old movies and not actually watching movies that were coming out in the year of. As I found out by becoming a Letterboxd patron, I only watched 21 movies from 2022, I think, which is absurd considering back when I was in college, I probably hit 21 movies in the first 2 months of the year. So it's fun to be doing that. And then I said, okay, but what else do people care about? And it's the one thing in this world I don't care about. There's a lot of things that people are like, no, there's got to be more that you don't care about. No, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been something that I have avoided like the plague throughout my entire life. You know, the people like when COVID was going on, like early in the early days, they'd be wearing goggles, like three masks, gloves, whatever. That's me with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like I can't stay safe enough and like free of it. So that's finally going to change as we decided we're going to watch them all in release order. We're not watching the shows. I'm not watching the mini series. I'm not watching the Guardians of the Galaxy Christmas special and podcasting about it, but I'll watch the theatrical movies. We're starting with Iron Man. We're going to work our way through. And every time a new one comes out, we'll add it to the list. So I think we figured it out. It was like, by the time we hit like mid 2024, late 2024, we'll have caught up to where the Marvel movies are, because we assume we'll miss a week here and there. So we're going to be doing a Marvel movie every week, and we're going to be doing a new release. Now, that new release next week is going to be Oppenheimer, so it could be a movie that's a week behind, because there's going to be some weeks where there's going to be two big movies that come out, and then there's going to be some weeks where nothing comes out. So this week, we're doing Barbie. Next week, it'll be Oppenheimer and The Incredible Hulk, which is actually one I haven't seen. I've seen most of the Phase 1 Marvel movies. I stopped after, what is it, the Avengers, but I haven't seen The Incredible Hulk. That's the only one of Phase 1 I haven't seen. So Iron Man was a rewatch for me. Anyway, all of that being said, welcome to the Marvel Cinematic Universe watch, and welcome to us actually being relevant and talking about movies that are new and fresh and people care about. They might care about Barbie too much. We'll have to talk about that in a little bit. But John, welcome to the show. I let you talk after 3 minutes.
I mean, it's great to be back. Obviously, like a month and a half, we had life take over after the daunting task of counting down our top 100, but you know, I've missed talking about movies, and it's a lot easier to get people to watch these movies with me than it was our top 100. I'm not going to lie.
Isn't that crazy? Like my wife couldn't wait to watch Iron Man and Barbie. And I was like, what do you mean? You could wait to watch, like, you know, The Deer Hunter. You could wait to watch Barcelona. You could wait to watch all these other depressing movies I had on there. Why can't you wait to watch these? I don't understand. Like, what do you mean? I'll call everybody uncultured, you know, just to make myself feel better about everything. But really, it's just we're kind of pains in the asses when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, we are. We are. Actually, Barbie, like, distinctly calls us out, but we'll call that. We'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. But this is such an interesting experience. I mean, especially with you not having seen these movies that have kind of been part of the cultural zeitgeist for the last 15 years now, and being able to go through it all and getting just like a raw reaction, because these are new to you and like you don't know what's happening in them because you avoided all information about them. So you actually don't know what happens. So everyone listening, please don't spoil Phil, because we want his completely unfiltered opinions on everything.
And it is going to be crazy, because I'm sure there's going to be so many absolutely shocking moments throughout these movies that I just don't see coming, because, you know, like Marvel movies are just nothing but shock, right? Not schlock, they're shock. I'm just going to be so surprised by the story turns that take place. And I mean, I'm about to be in it. This is going to be like The Usual Suspects all over again for me. But it is true what you're saying. I mean, like I said, I watched most of Phase 1. I know like the snap and I know all that stuff. But it's just something I lost so much interest in after the first Avengers. I was like, man, what's going on? And it's going to be fun to talk about Iron Man because Iron Man's actually a movie I enjoy. But I was driving my wife insane because I kept making little snide remarks during it. But I have a very serious reason for that, which we will talk about during this episode. But Jordan Alford with two comments right off the bat, proof that Phil has a heart, me doing the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I assume that means. And then we're in that 1%. I think a lot of film fans forget that. It's very true. Like we love that. And it's funny. I was watching during this break. I finally started catching up on my Ingmar Bergman. Where is it? There it is. It's over here. You see it there? Where's my hand? There it is. Down. I'm pointing down to it. I finally started catching up on that. And like I watch a movie like Saruman today. And I was like, oh, man, that was cool. It's like the sequel kind of to Scenes from a Marriage. And I know Scenes from a Marriage is pretty popular. So I'm like, oh, it probably has a good amount of reviews. It has like 41 fans, 9,000 members have watched it. Like it's barely anybody. And then you look at the top Barbie review right now, and it has like 23,000 likes or 24,000 likes. So it just kind of talks about like where we're at. And we did our fun, and now it's time to do a little bit of fun for everyone. And honestly, like even if I end up hating every single one of these Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, this is going to be enjoyable, and hopefully a lot of people just jump in to troll the shit out of me and the fact that I'm about to spend hours and hours and hours watching these movies. But anyway, so we're starting with Iron Man. I gave it 3 stars. John gave it 3.5. John, how many times have you seen Iron Man?
I think this is actually the only the second time I've seen it. Because I remember I didn't see it when it came out in 2008 for some reason. I saw The Incredible Hulk in theaters, never saw Iron Man in theaters. And it took me a while before I actually watched it.
Oh, I think, John, you froze. You said it took you a while before you actually
watched it. Before I actually watched it for the first time. And I don't think, I'm pretty sure it was like in a series rewatch for one of the earlier Avengers movies or something like mm-hmm. that. And I haven't rewatched it since. So it was kind of nice sitting down and remembering the fairly humble beginnings of the MCU with this one.
I remember when this came out. So when this released, I was 16, and this was around the time where I was really getting into movies. Like I'd always liked movies mm-hmm. growing up, but in high school was really when it was like, all right, like now we're talking. And I remember when this came out, it was shocking that it was going to be good because we'd seen a lot of bad movies up to this point. Batman Begins had come out and people really enjoyed Batman Begins. And we all knew, oh, Heath Ledger is going to play the Joker. And like there was this talk about it, but all the other movies that it kind of tried had kind of failed. Like Superman Returns mm-hmm. really wasn't that great. It was like long and drawn out. Nobody really talks about Superman Returns. And there's a couple other like superhero movies that just didn't land. And I remember when the reviews came out on this, people were like, Robert Downey Jr., what the hell are you talking about? Like, that guy, isn't he like a drug addict? Like, what is he doing? And then the movie gets phenomenal reviews. It's incredibly entertaining. It's really good popcorn flick stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of those things where you're like, all right, like this is going to be fun, not knowing the behemoth that was about to follow. Like, I was sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, this was only 15 years ago. Yeah. This was 15 years ago. They've been averaging 3 movies a year for the last 15 years. That's absolutely insane. And we talk a lot because now, obviously, when this movie came out, Disney had not bought Marvel yet. So this, you know, Disney now owns Marvel and everything like that. Disney owns Star Wars. And we've really seen Disney saturate the market with a lot of movies and series and franchises, which has made some of them stale. So not everything is a box office success, like something like Iron Man was. And I agree with you. It was kind of fun to just sit there and watch. Like, there's no convoluted storyline. It's a normal superhero movie. You're willing to turn your brain off for a second and just watch the thing. And it was really unexpected because Robert Downey Jr. up to this point, he was a non-entity. I think he only got paid $250,000 for this movie.
It's really, I know, like Terrence Howard made like 7 times what Robert Downey Jr. made in this movie.
And that's why Terrence Howard didn't come back for Iron Man 2, because he wanted more money. And they were like, no, because now we're actually going to pay Robert Downey Jr. and you're not the star anymore. So they got Don Cheadle instead, which always makes me laugh because think about where Terrence Howard and Don Cheadle are now. Terrence Howard is not the bigger star than Don Cheadle. It's just a fact.
No. It's going to be really interesting to witness that in a couple of weeks when I get to Iron Man 2. But it's so interesting to look at this aspect of the MCU because what a lot of people might not realize. Like, we're talking about how Robert Downey Jr., right? Like, he's coming off of his stint in rehab. He was this, the studio didn't want to hire him. Originally, Tom Cruise was supposed to play Tony Stark, but they turned it down. So, and they didn't want to pay as much as Tom Cruise would cost to be in this movie. And Jon Favreau really pushed for Robert Downey Jr. And it's because of that push for this single actor that we even have an MCU now. And to think of the fact that, like, the character of Iron Man is such a B-list superhero character. And it's one of those things that becomes really important with the way the MCU unfolds from here. This is a character that now is unfathomably popular, but used to be one of the most, like, ignored and despised characters in Marvel's catalog.
Well, and I think it's probably one of the smartest decisions that Marvel ever made. And I'm saying this as somebody who hasn't seen a lot of their movies, but it was a smart decision because you kind of went with someone that people weren't too familiar with. We'd seen the Sam Raimi Spider-Man. You couldn't start with a Spider-Man. Like, that just was never going to work. Everybody knew those to death. Superman obviously is DC anyway, but Superman was such a big name and it didn't work. So it was kind of like you needed to go and you needed to do something a little bit different. And I mean, chronologically, it was supposed to be Captain America anyway. And instead they do Iron Man because they really didn't know the success they were going to have. But with that ending scene, they always knew that there was going to be more. They just didn't know exactly how great it was going to be. And Jordan does make a good point here. You guys missed a huge opportunity not doing Oppenheimer this week. RDJ gave one of the best performances of his career, which is funny, though, because I didn't even realize Robert Downey Jr. was in Oppenheimer. That's how little I look into movies, like, before they come out, because I feel like everything gets spoiled.
I didn't realize it either, which is part of the reason why we didn't do Oppenheimer this week.
Yeah.
But it's okay. It means we just got to talk about nuclear radiation a lot next week instead.
We do. Yes, that's a good point, because we're going to be doing The Incredible Hulk with Edward Norton, who totally survived as the Hulk anyway. Yeah, we'll be talking about that next week. But I do, here's my biggest thing with Iron Man, and this is what was driving my wife absolutely insane, is so at the beginning of this movie they do the flashback, right? Like they show him and he's getting the selfie, whatever, and then they do the flashback to, like, the day before, and then everything takes place, and that flashback ends like 15 minutes later. Like, it's very quick. And as I said to my wife, I was like, it doesn't really make sense that they did that. I don't get it. And she's like, well, why does it matter? I'm like, well, that's called the first act. Why couldn't they just tell the first act in chronological order? Why did they have to have, like, this explosion, which really doesn't do anything? Like, it's one of the least, like I get it, like, puts him in there and it does the thing with his heart. But they could have just started the movie normal and done 14 minutes of Playboy Robert Downey Jr. and then the explosion. There's really no reason to show that explosion twice. So it was those types of nitpicks that were driving my wife insane. But I said to her, I said, the reason why I have to be like that with Iron Man, and I like Iron Man, but the reason why I have to be nitpicky with Iron Man is because it came out the same year as The Dark Knight. And there are so many people who try to make the argument that it's a better movie than The Dark Knight, because, like, also part of the reason why I stopped watching the Marvel movies was because the Marvel fans are just out of control. And I am literally making this series to make them happy and mad at the same time. It was like they're not comparable. Like, this is a pure popcorn, very fun movie, but The Dark Knight is so much more cerebral and, like, so much more artistic. And that's coming from somebody who had a Jon Favreau movie in, I think, his top 25.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things. So, like, well, I'm sitting there nitpicking and I'm like, but I can't help it, because I'm almost doing this as if I'm sitting there with the person who says Iron Man's a better movie than The Dark Knight. And I'm like, no. Like, these are every problem. My favorite part of the whole movie was when they did, okay, this is your last night. You better build my missile. And then he goes in there and he builds, like, the whole Iron Man suit. It's like where they just said, like, go back in there. You got one night. They didn't think he would try to do something in that night, so they didn't watch the video camera. They just, like, didn't watch what was going on in there. And then, like, they show the one scene of him out of view. And it's like, well, if he gets out of view, why don't you go in there and make sure he's doing the right thing? Like, you have all the guns. So it's that willing suspension of disbelief, and I'm willing to do it. But I think that's why I was always turned off from the Marvel movies after the Avengers hit, because the Avengers was treated like it was this masterpiece of epic proportion. And in reality, it's like a totally normal action movie. And that's when I had to start backing away because I'm like, okay, people love this so much and I'm never going to love it that much. And it's actually annoying me that they are talking about these movies like they are perfect entities. So anyway, that's what I say about Iron Man. But John, go ahead and put me in my place.
So I actually quite enjoy the opening to this. And I think it's because we get to see the transition point in Tony's character. One of the things I really admire about this movie and the way they do it, we spend so much time with Tony just doing the scientific method. There is so much time spent with Tony being like, I'm going to try this now. I'm going to try this. And when we're living in a world now where you get a superhero movie and it has to focus on like first act action, second act action, third act action, it's so nice to see how slowly paced this movie really is. And I think it's really important to kind of establish this, just this beginning part, because it really sets the tone for the difference in Tony's character after what he experiences. Yes, you could just put it chronologically in, but I think it's important to see this moment, get like just that moment of realization from Tony of this is a Stark missile, and then go back and see how much he doesn't care beforehand. It gives that higher contrast to the character, so you understand his heel turn a lot better.
Yeah, and I think they could have done it either way, but I do agree, like the whole thing with Tony Stark's character is much better developed than a lot of characters in superhero movies from the ones I've seen, or at least from the things I hear. They do a good job. And what they do a good job with in this one is they do ground it in reality. Do I buy that this guy's going to go and build the thing that's going to then make him build a suit that's going to let him like have this infinite power? No, but that's not the point. What I love is that's the superhero element, right? Like they need to have that superhero element. They need to have the out of reality element. But they ground this movie in the reality of super rich guy who's a weapons dealer, who does all this. And I know that this is in the comic. I've never read the comic. I'm not going to pretend I did. But I get that this is in there. But I think it's very – they did a good job of putting it like in they did a good job of putting it in the movie and telling it in the way that they did. Because especially in 2008, like – you got to remember, this is right on the tail end in America. What? George Bush is still president. He's about to not become president. Barack Obama is about to take over in November, right? He takes over in November of 2008 because elections in 2008. So, So Bush is at the end of his term. The whole Bush thing, he was the most popular president of all time. And then he became the least popular president of all time in the same 8 years. Like, that's how insane it was. And so everybody in America, what's on their mind is the war in the Middle East that nobody understands. Nobody knows what's going on. What are we actually fighting for? Nobody knows. And this movie kind of brings that with it and does a lot with the Middle East and kind of like the stereotypes that Americans had for Middle East and all of that, which might not be good and don't age well. And I think a lot of the jokes in Iron Man, they crack me up because I'm like, remember, this is only 15 years ago, guys. Yeah. We act like we're living, like we're so holier than thou now that like 15 years ago, you forget Tony Stark was making a lot of jokes that in 2023 would have him banned and expelled from society. But which by the way, I appreciate the 2008 humor, thank God. But I thought that was really well done. And it's something that like the Nolan Batman movies were doing as well that make them a little bit better. Just they ground it and make it like a reality. And this doesn't have the ending of let's blow up the entire city so that the Avengers win. It has the ending of like Tony Stark actually carefully trying to save all the other people around. And again, keeping it within a reality of like an arms dealer who makes his whole money off of war, who is now trying to become peaceful. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's this idea. This is why the choice to use Iron Man works so well, because despite the fact that this is a character the majority of the population can never actually connect with, because, you know, the millionaire philanthropist playboy type character, right?
Yeah,
but he's still an average person. Yeah, okay, he's like super smart and stuff, but he's still the average person, and it makes it the leap to superhero for this average person doesn't feel as far as someone who has superpowers themselves, right?
Yes. Yeah,
and it makes it a lot easier to connect. And because you're dealing with this real world situation. I mean, 2008, that's the end of the war in Iraq, and as everything switching over towards Afghanistan instead. It's really grounded there. I mean, it's pretty not just topical, but a lot of media at that time was like dealing with this kind of like Islamophobia and everything. Think about like what was popular on TV, right? Like 24 still going on. Let me tell you, that show's aged very poorly. Even like something like Lost has an entire character that's around this concept of like
foreign. Lost was trying to subvert it, right?
They were except for that one episode where they legitimately just had terrorism in it. But yeah, they were trying to subvert it and everything and Lost. But like these are the type of things that we're seeing. We even had like the year prior to this, you have Charlie Wilson's War comes out, which actually talks about like arming Al-Qaeda with you know, American arms. And like that's what this is getting into, this idea of like, and this critique of where are these weapons coming from, right? And where are they going? And like, where is this like moral boundary of, if you're creating weapons, do you always know who's using them?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, you know, kind of the fun thing about Iron Man too, is Iron Man is a hero, but he's not really a hero. I'd say he's probably one of the more flawed of all the Avengers, right? Yeah. I mean, because Captain America is just like Captain America, and like, sure, he might have some, but they don't feel as real as the flaws of Iron Man, because Iron Man's flaws are so realistic of just like, once you hit a certain level of wealth, some people just let it go to their heads and they don't care. And it's okay, you're in my way of doing what I want to do and building this. And I mean, there's a lot of Elon Musk in Iron Man. I mean, I know Elon Musk like wasn't Elon Musk in 2008, but there's so much of that where it's just like, yeah, I'm going to go build this thing because I can. And it does kind of have that same element. But I think the fact that there's a bit of an anti-hero edge to Tony Stark is what makes Iron Man more relatable and makes it a little bit more fun than just like your typical, like, I mean, the only other one I saw was Black Panther, because I did watch Black Panther because of the Oscars. I cannot believe I'm going to sit down and watch that movie again, because I absolutely hated every second of it. But like, that's one where I feel like the most interesting character in the movie is Michael B. Jordan. And he's not, you know, because I feel like the actual Black Panther character isn't that compelling to me. So I feel like the Tony Stark character, and that's why people like it. And I think it also helps a lot because Robert Downey Jr. in real life was kind of like this, right? Like Robert Downey Jr. in real life was kind of like a spoiled guy who grew up and did drugs and did all this stuff and like had it made in Hollywood and then blew it. And then he comes back, and like now, I mean, Robert Downey Jr.'s personality is totally different than Tony Stark's in real life. Like if you watch interviews with him and stuff like that, but man, he had to work his ass off to get back to where he was, but he's kind of playing his original self. It almost feels like in this, who is Elon? Well,
I actually think Elon's in two, if I recall correctly. But it's really interesting because there was actually an article that came out in with like Oppenheimer stuff and everything, where Robert Downey Jr. said that playing Tony Stark kind of ruined his acting career because he didn't have to try at all. Right? Because he was just playing himself. And even if you look at like the movies that he was doing in this time, right? Like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, we watched, this is essentially the same character, just like wealthy. And then you like look at even like the Sherlock Holmes movies he made, stuff like that. Like he played the same character over and over and over again. And you look at his other films that were like non-MCU movies during that run where he was in the MCU. You had what, The Judge, which everyone like did not like. And then he followed up with Doolittle, which was a steaming pile. And so to see, like, it's this perfect casting, but it kind of has this thing where it's like, is he acting or is he just being himself? And because it's such a fine line in this movie, you buy into it more.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, this was the same year. I mean, this is really when Robert Downey Jr. took off, but this was the same year as Tropic Thunder when he got his Oscar nomination for Tropic Thunder. So, that definitely helps. I mean, people don't realize, because like now it's at the point where like, you know, Robert Downey Jr. is Robert Downey Jr., but he literally like spent a full year in prison. Like,
he was like 15 months or something like that.
Yeah, like, he was sentenced to 3 years and he only did 1 year, but he was like totally like actually in prison, and people don't realize that now. You know, it's not just your typical like Hollywood asshole story where it's like, oh, this person did this and is constantly obnoxious and are they on drugs? I don't know. Like, Robert Downey Jr. literally was in jail, and now he's arguably one of the top five most famous people in the world. Like, from an acting perspective, like, I'd say he's probably top five. I mean, he's Iron Man.
Yeah. As he says at the end of the film.
Yes, exactly. Which is a big moment. I always love this, because the whole thing with all these superhero movies was always like, oh, we got to keep it hidden. Who am I? You know, the Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi ones, it was always, will Tobey Maguire ever be found out? I love that in this one. It's just like, nah, I'm him.
Well, and that, it's such a turning point for the way superhero movies are approached too. Like, the ripple effect of ending this movie with I am Iron Man, it sets up what the MCU can be, right? All of a sudden, we can do away with secret identities. It doesn't matter anymore, because, like, people can know. Obviously, like, we get into more details of that further along into the MCU. But for the most part, the anonymity of being a superhero isn't there. And it changes the way you can approach these movies. And it was really this real smart way to end this film. Because it is like a defining moment in Tony Stark's character. Because if you recall, they're given the story about, like, he's your bodyguard and stuff, right? In the early comics, like Avengers comics, that was like legit the storyline for who Iron Man was. Is that he was just Tony Stark's bodyguard. And to do away with that and be like, no, we don't care. We are abolishing the alter ego, we are abolishing the secret identity, and we're doing this, allows you to be so much bigger with the way you approach these movies.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, and I mean, I don't know, we'll see if it works or not. I'll be the determiner of that as we go forward. But I mean, it was kind of like a nice thing though to see, like, oh, okay, they're just gonna, like, he's just going to own it. Because I always thought in all the superhero movies, I always find it funny when they're like, I'm trying to keep my identity hidden. It's like, if Bruce Wayne just said he was Batman and like that he was like, you know, doing this to like try to like get rid of the Joker, but people have really hated him all that much. Like, he had enough money to pay off the media, didn't he? Like, couldn't he have just like figured that out? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I always just find it funny when they're like, we're going to go through this convoluted plot to not let people know who I am. In this one, they do. And, also, John, and I'm not calling you out because you got your headphones on the top of your head, but in like 10 years, you might be an automatic bad guy in a Marvel movie. Because
I know.
Because if you have no hair, you're automatically a villain. I don't know if you know that or not.
Even like the fake out villain in this movie is bald.
It's bald.
So I know. Yeah. Although bald Jeff Bridges, I mean, it almost doesn't feel like Jeff Bridges when you see him.
It you're very right, especially with the goatee and everything. He's got like a WWE kind of look. He's got like a Bill Goldberg, Stone Cold Steve Austin look to him.
Yeah, and like, I always forget, like, I sat down and I started it and I see him for the first time, like, oh yeah, that's Jeff Bridges. And it just like, it throws me off. I really enjoy this character though, and the way they do it. I like the reveal that he's the bad guy. And just like, it's in this scene that seems like completely inconsequential. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm in charge. That's why I paid you to kill Tony Stark.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay. It elevates everything. And now you're just like wondering, it's like, okay, what's going on here? But we're not at a point where, like, you know, the villain's monologuing to Tony to explain everything either. That comes later. We do get that point eventually, but it's not the reveal and the monologue. I think separating the two really helps with the pacing of the film.
Yeah, the monologue comes more when they're like actually fighting, right?
Well, it's more when he like goes and takes the arc reactor out of Tony's chest.
Yeah.
That's
true. Yeah, I like Jeff Bridges. I thought Jeff Bridges was a good villain, and I think a lot of times superhero movies are elevated by their villains because the superheroes themselves are generally whatever. You know what you're going to get from the superheroes. So it's always the villains. Like, whenever these movies come out, it's always who's going to play blah, blah, blah. I remember when Tom Hardy was coming out as Bane, people were like losing their freaking minds because it was like, what? Like, it's going to be Tom Hardy and we just had Heath Ledger as this. And like, that's what people are more concerned about. And you know, that's why I laugh when I look up the Incredible Hulk, which we're going to do next week. And I'm like, oh yeah, Tim Roth was the villain in that, huh?
Yep.
What a time to be alive. But yeah, so Iron Man's a good way to start it. I mean, I was, you know, that's kind of what got me feeling like I could do this was I'm going to start with Iron Man and I'm going to slowly work my way through. And I'm going to be okay. You know, it's very inoffensive. It's very entertaining. The most offensive thing about the movie is that Jon Favreau has himself playing happy. Give me a break, dude. You're not that tough. We just watched you be the biggest little bitch of all time 12 years earlier in Swingers. You're not this big hard ass. And I think it's so funny that he has himself play like this tough guy character. He's directing himself as a tough guy.
It's great. It's like the episode of The Sopranos with Jon Favreau in it, though, right? Like,
yeah,
like it feels like it's right out of that we're getting him. I like it. I like the cameo. There are a lot of like niche things in this movie that are like really nice Easter eggs. Things like the terrorist organization being called the Ten Rings, which is a reference to the Ten Rings of the Mandarin. Well, it's complicated. We'll get there eventually when it actually like becomes relevant and stuff. But like, just the Mandarin is like one of the big Iron Man villains, and he has these 10 rings that he gets magical powers from. So it's like those little tiny things, like the bodyguard thing too. There are a couple more things I want to mention about the film before we move on, though.
Well, you better hurry up because I've had about enough talking Marvel for one.
I know. The sequence where Tony finally goes to Afghanistan, blows up all the weaponry and stuff, and then has the jets flying after him is such an important sequence in this film. Not because it's like establishing like what Tony's doing, but it actually establishes Tony as a hero because after he, you know, breaks the plane, he then still goes to rescue the pilot. It's such a small act, but it really goes to show the difference in Tony's character from earlier in the movie. When we saw this selfish playboy who's like only in it for himself, his immediate instinct in this is make sure this guy doesn't die.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with that. And it's also, that's like the scene where they're all ready to turn on him and kill him. And then he does that. And it's like, okay, like this guy's not all bad. And then it's a, well, was it a training exercise gone wrong? Which like seriously cracked me up because back in like the mid 2000s, everything was a training exercise gone wrong. I mean, they're just blowing up villages in the Middle East and everything was a training exercise gone wrong.
Yeah. I also really appreciate the final fight here between like the Ironmonger and Iron Man, and that Tony doesn't outgun Jeff Bridges' character, right? Like he doesn't outgun him. He outsmarts him with like going up and the freezing that we had already seen, right? Like it's these little things that again really point out to the character of Tony, and like that was so much emphasis on the character in this rather than the action itself.
Yeah, which I mean, just from watching Black Panther, I felt like was not the case as it went on. And I mean, I remember with the first Avengers, oh my God, I was like, so it's just explosions. And like, I get it. I mean, it's fun that we have all this technology and stuff so we can pull this all off now. But yeah, it was kind of nice. Like, it's almost like when you watch the James Bond movies in the early days and you watch like Dr. No, and it's literally like 7 minutes of Dr. No, and like they just run around and the Dr. No's dead. That kind of like was what this felt like, where it was like, okay, like how long is this going to go on for? And then it went on for like a normal, like 10 to 15 minutes. The movie's two hours and 6 minutes long. Like it's all very digestible. It's all very, very digestible. And then I go and I look and Avengers Endgame is 181 minutes long. And I'm like, oh my God, is that story? Cause I like a lot of 3 hour movies. My number one movie of all time is 3 hours, but is that story or is that just to blow things up? That's what I need to know.
Yeah. Well, we're going to find out over the next several weeks.
That's a long time from now, but
yeah.
All right. Can I stop talking about it or do I have to keep going?
I think we can't not talk about the post-credit scene because it kind of changed the landscape.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
It kind of changed the landscape of cinema, right?
I mean, I don't know if it changed the landscape of cinema because I think these are so cheesy, but it certainly in this one was very exciting when that happened. Like this was the talk, man. It was, wow, you got to stay for the post credit scene, blah, blah, blah. And really when you think about all the post credit scenes now, this one's so short. It's so quick. Yeah. It's so to the point. It's just Samuel Jackson being like, I have an eye patch. What are you doing? I'm talking about the Avengers. And you're like, oh, that's fun. That's nice. There's going to be Avengers. Like they're going to do this. that I think it's like really fun that they did it. And then just like I said, with everything else Disney has done recently, and I think with like the Marvel and Star Wars and all that, they beat the crap out of it and just made it to the point where it was like, okay, did you really need one in every one of these movies? But it has kind of become the staple. It's almost like the opening credits of the Bond films where like it needs to be there or you feel cheated.
Yeah, it's to the point where people don't leave a theater unless the lights go up.
Yeah.
When they go watch a movie now. I mean,
any movie, even with,
like Barbie, just this weekend, like nobody would leave. And it's like, there's no post-credit. But you also like look up before you go to a movie or as you're sitting there as the credits are rolling, if there's a post-credit scene to figure out if you can leave or not.
Yeah. Yep. No, I totally agree. Yeah. Especially with like the bigger movies, like, you know, an Oscar movie, you're not going to look that up. But with these bigger, like, you know, sci-fi, superhero, whatever movies, like you need to look because, yeah, these movies really did make it say like, oh, I got to sit through the credits, which like, God, nobody wants to sit through the credits. I had to sit through the credits of a movie my name appeared in just so it could say like assistant two. And then it had my name. And I was, by the way, I was not I was the assistant to someone, but it just made me laugh. Cause I'm like, I just sat through these credits. I didn't look at anybody else's name. I just, so I could see my own name. And then I just walked out of the theater. You know what I mean? But it's just like, that's what we,
I will say, I do like sitting through the credits to get to the orchestral names, but those are the ones those are the only real ones I pay attention to.
Yeah, you can look it up on IMDb after
that. I know. I know. But
that's how I feel.
I also just don't like the crowded rush as everyone leaves the theater. Be like, okay, I'll sit here.
It also depends on the movie. I mean, if it's a movie that really hit me, like I think the first time I saw Moonrise, I think I sat through the entire credits just because I didn't want to get up. And then you get like the people coming in to clean up the popcorn and they're like, get the hell out of my theater. But, you know, still. Yeah, it did change it though. And I mean, it was one of those things, like I said, 2008, when you didn't know there were going to be 45 movies or whatever the hell the number is now, it was like, wow, they're going to like have more of these. That'll be fun. But you got to remember back in 2008, we were still talking trilogies. Yeah. That was like what people did. Remember at that point, Indiana Jones was still a trilogy, right? Star Wars was.
Oh no,
trilogy.
That's not true.
Indiana Jones
had just become a quadrology.
Oh, had it? Okay. So it was starting to happen. For the most part, though, it was trilogies. It was trilogies, trilogies, trilogies.
Well, and it was like, even if we look at Star Wars, right? Like, Star Wars had to, you didn't get just one new Star Wars film, you got a trilogy of Star Wars films, because that's the way things worked back then.
And so you thought it was going to be kind of like, okay, you're going to have this, all the Avengers are going to have their own movie. And now we have a movie for everybody who's ever farted in an Avengers movie. So here we go, you know, whatever. Yeah, I can't wait. I'm moving on, John. I'm doing it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Iron Man, though. So I'm going to rank these as I go through so that you guys can really see my disgust as I go. Right now, Iron Man is my number one. It is definitely my number one. Don't worry.
Wild. I would have never expected.
You would have never guessed, right? I've been dying to say that to you just so you could roll your eyes. But all right, we're going to talk about Barbie now. So Barbie, probably one of the hype. This was the most hyped weekend maybe like since I've been alive in terms of multiple movies. And I know there's been weekends where like, you know, when Avengers Endgame came out, people were like, holy crap, this is going to be epic. But like in terms of two movies getting so much hype, it's been a damn long time. And I would argue with Christopher Nolan's name attached to it, with Ryan Gosling, Greta Gerwig, and Margot Robbie attached to it. Cillian Murphy's not an A-list star. He will be now, but he's not.
He always should have been, but that's a topic for another time.
Exactly. And Emily Blunt's, right? Emily Blunt plays the wife in that?
Yeah,
she's like a B+, if you know what I mean. Like she was in a Quiet Place, like there's not really much else there. But still, because of the names that we're talking about on this weekend, this was one of the most hyped weekends ever. Now, John, I know you buy into hype, and that's why you ultimately came out of this weekend a little disappointed, but we're not talking about Oppenheimer till next week. I don't buy into that. I didn't buy into the hype so much because I think of my resistance to movies like these Iron Man and Marvel movies. So for me, I went into Barbie. I sat down. I don't like to watch trailers nowadays because I think they just give away everything and it's so obnoxious and I hate it. So I didn't watch, I had not seen a single trailer for Barbie. I didn't know that everybody was just playing Ken. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't watch the music video for I'm Just Ken or anything like that. I just went into the theater and I watched it. I didn't wear pink. I didn't wear my Barbie shirt. I didn't do any of that stuff, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good, solid 3-star movie. And if people keep talking about it the way that they're talking about it, I'm going to go the way of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I'm going to hate it real freaking fast. So anyway.
You know what? Like, the thing with Barbie, it's a fun movie. It's a very fun movie. I don't know if I would say I bought into the hype of it, and that's why I was disappointed. Because, oh, spoiler alert, I was disappointed in it. I think I was more disappointed because I knew who wrote it, and I expected more from them. Is what it comes down to. Like, knowing that Greta Gerwig and Noah Bumba are writing this, I expect, like, wittier dialogue. I expected a little more nuance to the film, and we didn't get that. Now, I get it. This is a wide release, big studio movie. The fact that these two people were tied to this movie at all in the first place is astounding.
Yeah.
But, like, I just wanted a little more depth, I guess, and not just like the surface level stuff we got. Now, I get it. We're two 30-year-old guys talking about a movie about female empowerment. Mm-hmm. But this movie, it felt really heavy-handed at times.
Yeah, so I gave this movie 3 stars. It was definitely closer to a 2.5 than 3.5. And I think one of the biggest things with this was having Gerwig and Bumba attached to it, where its biggest strength and its biggest weakness. Because I think without them, this movie is not good. I will just flat out say that without them, this movie is not good. Because there was enough Gerwig and enough Bumba in there. Mm-hmm. And Gerwig's style comes through with her direction. Because the production design in this movie is gorgeous. This movie looked amazing. The fake sets. The way that she would have Margot Robbie fall over, acting like she was a Barbie doll, where she wouldn't bend her knees and her arms and stuff like that. Like, all of those little details were absolutely fantastic. And I think a lot of that comes from Greta Gerwig and Bumba. But, I mean, shoot me. I'm ready. Come find me and kill me. The America Ferrera speech is horrific. Like, I'm sorry, but it is so over the top. And it is beating you on the skull with Thor's hammer that we've already gotten for the entire movie. Like, I already get it. I get it. Like, that's the point of the movie. Like, it's all in there. It's all been established. It's all been laid out in very clear detail that, like, women are not being respected because of all the things that they're doing. No matter what they do, it's not good enough. We see Barbie go, she's doing what she's doing. And in this world, everything's perfect in Barbie Land. And then she goes out into the real world and everything's falling apart. And, like, you know, it's just, she's not having the impact she thought she was going to have. And it's the same thing we see with America Ferrera's character as the mom. And we see her struggling as she's trying to do right by her daughter, but her daughter's not happy with her and her daughter's not happy with this and blah, blah, blah. It's so clear. It's so clear. And to have like a 2.5 minute monologue about it and like the constant cuts to like Margot Robbie's like almost tearing up face, I was just like, I get it. Like, I get it. I get it. I get it. And it was one of those things. It was very funny because the theater I was in was a huge mix of people. We had like children there. We had like a group of girls who were there, like as just like friends. We had couples there. So I got to kind of see all of it. I heard groans from the theater. Now I do live in Florida, so I don't know what that says, but it was like, dude, it's just, I got it. I got it. I got it. I got it. And I get that some people are going to sit here and say that that's the best part of the movie, but it was the things like that where it's so heavy handed. And that's the biggest knock on it, because Noah Bumba and Greta Gerwig are not heavy handed.
Yes.
Little Women does so much more for female empowerment than that speech does. I'm sorry. It just does. Yeah. Like it just does. And Little Women is not beating you on the skull with a mallet.
And that's what really got me with the film. Like, it's a good film. Sometimes the biggest sin a movie can commit is not being bad and not being great.
Yeah.
And just knowing that Greta Gerwig's here, and even, like, looking at interviews with Greta Gerwig afterwards where it's talking about, like, the studio wanted them to cut the scene on the bench where she turns to the old lady and says, "You were so beautiful." Mm-hmm. And that sequence leading up to that scene and like that line delivery is one of the best parts of the entire movie, in my opinion.
I completely agree.
And it's like, this is where we're seeing Greta Gerwig in this movie. And when we get this America Ferrera speech, it feels like that's when we're seeing the studio.
Yep.
And again, like, I get what they're doing with it. And I understand what they're trying to say, because what they're trying to say is really important. It is dealing with a lot of like, like Jordan said, like you're deconstructing a widely popular toy, and like you're explaining feminism and the patriarchy and society as a whole. Like there's a lot you're dealing with, and you're dealing with it through this toy that is praised for female empowerment, but at the same time criticized for these unrealistic expectations that it sets for women and things like that, right? And like it explores that really well in the film, but it doesn't have the nuance, which is what I wanted and what I expected out of these writers and director.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And like, if you think of, so this is Greta Gerwig's third real directed movie, like, right? Like you, Lady Bird, Little Women, this, those are like really the three movies she directed. If she has shorts and stuff in there, like I don't, I don't follow it enough. All of her movies are so strong.
Yeah.
But this is, to me, this is the weakest by far. And it's fun. I mean, look, it's Barbie. I get it. It's easy to latch onto. It's, I gave it 3 stars. I was still entertained. I still enjoyed it. And we're going to get into the good stuff here. We are. But I just feel like Greta Gerwig is so sharp. She's one of the best writers out there. She really is. She's one of the best directors out there. I don't think she should have been nominated for Little Women, but the Lady Bird situation, yeah. The Little Women year was just a great year. But this is like, this can't go down as like what people talk about with Greta Gerwig. But what I appreciate about this, because people did like Little Women and they did like Lady Bird, but they're smaller movies. Those are you and me movies, and then people who've heard of Little Women, right? What I'm hoping that this does is that this brings attention to Greta Gerwig so that Greta Gerwig can go and make it so that when Greta Gerwig makes a movie, people are having the reaction they're having to Christopher Nolan making a movie, even though the last movie that Christopher Nolan made was a steaming pile of garbage that roasted in the sun for years and years and years. And I need to go on Letterboxd and drop down to like a half star. But everybody's still so stoked that he's making Oppenheimer. And I hope that Barbie does that for Greta Gerwig, where when another Greta Gerwig movie comes out, people are like, I need to stop what I'm doing and go watch it. Because Greta Gerwig is just incredibly talented.
She's a fantastic filmmaker.
Yeah. And you know what? I want her and Noah Baumbach to write more stuff together, because when they collaborate, it's always great. And Frances Ha is like a phenomenal movie. So give me more of that. I appreciate this. I thought it was good, but I totally agree with you. You could feel the studio interference. That's what I'm going to call it. I'm going to call it studio interference. You could feel it.
Well, and I mean, you have to look at like Mattel itself as a producer on this movie. So like it can only go so far. And I think my issue with it is because it's so present, because this idea of like the patriarchy, and like, I thought it was hilarious seeing Ryan Gosling's Ken, because we definitely have to refer to them by their actor names in this movie because they're all named the same thing. Discovers the patriarchy. Like, it's hilarious.
It's so good.
So funny. Like, as he's like watching this and all these like stereotypical male things happening, it's so funny. And for this to be like the primary opposition of the movie makes so much sense. But you have this like weird B plot with like the Mattel executives that doesn't go anywhere. And you have like the conclusion of this movie is, let's take everything in Barbie Land and put it back to the way it was before. And, you know, yes, men need to identify as themselves and stuff. And like, it's got that great message at the end where like, you know, I'm just Ken. But like, it's not, it's also not proposing a solution to the patriarchy at the same time. It's not suggesting like, this is how, because if you look at Barbie Land, it's kind of the exact opposite of like the real world in this movie.
And I think the message,
not suggesting any like way of resolving that.
I think the message at the end is like, no, like I think it gets to a little bit of it, because that's when Barbie's like, it doesn't have to be girls' night every night. Yeah. And I think that's kind of like the fun part of it. I thought the whole part with Ruth was so corny. And I mean, everybody who's gone to see this has said people have cried during that in the theater. Again, I was in a sold out show. Nobody was crying during that part. You can hear it when people cry. Maybe they were doing the little tears, but I didn't hear anybody crying. And like, my sister went and saw it the same day as us, in like maybe like 10 miles from where we saw it. And she's like, oh my God, everybody was crying at that part. And I'm like, okay. But I like the fun. I think this needed to stay fun. I think when it tried to be too serious, it was like, why are you trying to be so serious? You don't need to be. And I do think the whole idea of like, it doesn't have to be girls' night every night. That's the fun message of it. Not this whole, like, it's good to be human and like, whatever. Like, it just, I feel like the problem with this movie was it was so scattered. It was just, it was all over the place. And just down to the beginning, there had to have been a simpler way to make the connection between Barbie Land and the real world. Then somebody drew a picture and now she's like losing her feet and she's doing this and she's doing that. This movie could have been Elf. Like, this movie literally could have been Elf, where it could have been like, Barbie, you need to go and you need to get this girl to like believe in herself, because she's not, like, you know, it's like Elf has the story of your dad's on the naughty list. Like, it could have been that. But it felt so convoluted. And then I felt like for the rest of the movie, it was kind of trying to juggle between these two things. And you brought up the Mattel thing. So I actually found the Mattel guys to be pretty funny. I like the, you know, the whole idea of it.
I agree.
The men are running everything. Where's your woman in charge? No, it's me, but I have daughters and friends who are women and all that. Like, I get it. And I think Will Ferrell, like, is just a funny guy. Like, he's just a naturally funny guy. So it doesn't matter. But I also felt like, again, we were talking about the studio. I feel like Bumbaugh and Gerwig probably wanted to make jokes at Mattel, but I feel like Mattel almost felt like they were going to get off scot-free by making fun of themselves so much, because a lot of the jokes are about Mattel, and it feel like Mattel's sitting there like patting themselves on the back, like, look at us, we can laugh at ourselves. And it's like, okay, I don't disagree and I appreciate that, but it felt like the only reason they were in the movie was so that Mattel could kind of get the gold star pinned on their back to be like, we laugh at ourselves. Isn't that great? That's just what I
thought. I just agree with that. But you know what? We've been pretty negative. Let's be positive about this.
All right.
Because there are some really great parts in this movie. I mean, Ryan Gosling as a whole, man.
He's going to, dude, he's so getting funny. An Oscar nomination. He's going to get an Oscar nomination for this. I think it's going to happen. I really do. People love Ryan Gosling. He used to get nominated for movies he shouldn't have. And then he stopped getting nominated when there's movies he should have. And I think with him taking his little break and with The Gray Man just kind of being whatever it was, I think he's going to get a nomination for this. He's phenomenal. And I mean, I'm just Ken. I seriously think he might be looking at an Oscar winner in that song.
Yeah,
I really do. And the reason that works is because of Ryan Gosling. And Simu Liu is freaking amazing in this movie.
So funny.
So
funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like there's this fantastic chemistry between the Kens. And it just, like, even when we get to this point where, you know, the Kens have taken over and they have their, like loco whatever house.
It's the dojo. The dojo casa house.
The Mojo Dojo Casa.
Yeah, the Mojo Dojo. The Kens Mojo Dojo Casa house.
Like, it's ridiculous, but these men are just working so well off each other. And I mean, we'd be remiss not to also mention, we got Michael Cera playing Michael Cera again,
which is so nice.
And it was so perfect. It felt like this, like, warm embrace of this thing we've been missing in our lives. Just like having Michael Cera as Alan, perfect casting, and just like perfect amount in the film too.
Yeah, no, Alan is great. And it's fun that, like, you know, Mattel really went in with like their crappy Barbie, crappy Alan characters that they did that just like totally didn't work. But the I'm just Ken scene, how it takes itself so seriously, and then like they're doing the dance and the choreography and stuff, like that's again where, like, I feel like Gerwig was coming through more than the studio. I feel like that was really happening. And like Ryan Gosling was allowed to just play and have fun, and him walking around in his cowboy hat and him going in and being like, so I'm a man and I want to have a job. And they're like, well, do you have a PhD and an MBA? And he's like, no, but the patriarchy said I could have this job. And like Ryan Gosling taking all that very, very seriously. He's just so good in his little feuds with the other Kens and everything. Like, I love that stuff. And I think the Kens have better chemistry than the Barbies. I think the Barbies, the Barbies, maybe it was because the Barbies all kind of have like their different look and there's different dolls and there's different all that stuff. I felt like the Barbies kind of all played very similarly. And the only difference was like, okay, this one's the president. or this one's the weird one. I just didn't feel like they were – I thought the Kens were more interesting.
I kind of agree, which like kind of sucks coming out of this movie saying that, where it's like the titular characters, aside from the stereotypical Barbie that is Margot Robbie, they do feel very similar. Like they feel like background characters, and it's like their only way of differentiating them is their profession. Like it almost feels counterintuitive as to what the message of this movie is trying to be.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's, again, where they were struggling with the balance here. I think they were having a hard time figuring out where they wanted to put the emphasis on things. I think they could have totally done away with America Ferrera and Ariana Greenblatt. They didn't need either one of them in this movie, and it would have been fine. And they really didn't need the Will Ferrell stuff, as much as I like Will Ferrell. There was a way to do this movie where it really did focus more on Barbie and Ken. And I get like, or the Barbies and the Kens. Because you know, the ending is right. It does. It doesn't need to go into the whole love story element of like, oh, Barbie and Ken got together. That's not what the point of the movie is. But it kind of loses its way along, and it's like, okay, we got to keep trudging along. And yeah, I don't know. I agree with you. The stereotypical Barbie is the best by far. And but the Kens as a whole, I felt like I knew them more than I knew the Barbies.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is because a lot of this movie's focused on Ryan Gosling. Like, as much as this movie's like, obviously Margot Robbie is like the titular character of the movie and also gives a fantastic performance. Like,
yeah,
Margot Robbie is just phenomenal in everything she's in. But it's just, it's weird because like the characterization, because it's almost like, because this is a stereotypical Barbie, we don't get as much depth as we should get from a Margot Robbie character.
Yeah, I agree with that. But okay, so yeah, again, this just kind of goes to like, what were our expectations with it, right? Because it does have Gerwig and Mumba attached to it, so that doesn't help. But I said I was going to say this beforehand, and since you brought up Margot Robbie and that she's good, the biggest takeaway from this movie, the biggest positive to come out of Barbie, is that Margot Robbie's career was saved. Because if this was not a success, we might not see Margot Robbie anymore. Yeah. I like really firmly believe that. Amsterdam was a flop. Babylon, as amazing as I thought that movie was a flop. It was a box office disaster. She needed this so bad because it was she was starting to lose that shine a little bit. And I think it hurt her because she went and did Harley Quinn and those movies weren't that successful. And the Harley Quinn role did not really work for her, but she was getting kind of pigeonholed and she was stuck and she didn't have anything else. And then she's going, she's taking these tougher movies. I love Margot Robbie. I think she's fantastic. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, her Sharon Tate is ridiculous. Oh. She's so good in Babylon. No matter what the Damien Chazelle haters want to say, she is freaking amazing. And her character is terrific. She's very good in I, Tonya. I mean, I, Tonya, she is phenomenal. So it's great that this is going to save her career now, because now this movie's already made $356 million worldwide already. $356 million worldwide.
That's another important thing to talk about this movie and like what it's done for the movie industry. Like, yeah, we're in the middle of a lot of contract disputes and a lot of like strikes with the WGA and SAG-AFTRA and everything like that. And we're at a point where there's like this hyper focus on the movie industry. COVID almost killed this.
Yeah.
To a point where people didn't think this type of weekend could happen again. This is the largest opening weekend since Avengers Endgame, which was the culmination of 12 years of movies.
Yeah.
Like, this is the largest opening weekend for a film directed by a woman ever. Like, this is a
big deal. And that's crazy because Wonder Woman was directed by a woman.
Yeah, that was the last record.
Like,
this is a big deal. And I posted it on Facebook that, you know what, maybe I didn't really enjoy these movies as much as everyone else did, but it's so nice seeing people flock to movie theaters again.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And like, just to put this in perspective for how Robbie's been doing, Amsterdam made $31 million total.
Yeah.
Babylon made $66 million total. This movie's made $356 million worldwide. And to no surprise, in China, it didn't do well. Because in China, I mean, this is a lot of like feminism. There's definitely like LGBT characters in this. Like, that's not something that's going to fly in China. China was mad, right? Because of the map. I think there was like a whole thing about how the map wasn't drawn properly. So it was going to get banned. It only made $8 million in China. Probably it, not probably, the second biggest market behind the US, China. Mm-hmm. And it still made $356 million opening weekend. Yep. That's insane. So I'm happy for it. I'm very, and again, like what I appreciate about Barbie is it is a very creative movie. It's a very unique movie with a very creative movie. A lot of great moments. The characters are fun. The production design is amazing. The direction is really good. But ultimately, the studio smacked their fist down a couple too many times. And I just think like it's been done to death. Like I don't know. I mean, I know we're in different parts of the world, but like a line that totally fell flat in this theater was the one about the one day the Kens will have as much power as the women in the real world. Like it fell so flat in the theater. And I was like, it was almost like one of those where I'm like, oh my God, I feel like somebody just told a one liner at like a movie, like at something and it like didn't land. And like now you're uncomfortable and you almost feel like you have to chuckle like to make them feel better.
That did land in my theater.
It did land in your theater. So maybe it's just going to land in different parts of the world. I'm sure in LA it landed like great.
Yeah.
But it's just like one of those things where I feel like there were times where it was like, okay, we get it. Where like the Margot Robbie, when they're talking about how she doesn't feel beautiful and stuff, and Helen Mirren jumps in there and says like, you know, note to the filmmakers, if you're going to make this point, you can't have Margot Robbie doing it. That landed. And I feel
that didn't land for me.
That's funny.
Like it didn't land.
That's funny. So it's just going to depend on where you are.
Yeah.
I guess. But all of that's just to say, I feel like there's so much heavy-handedness in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to bitch about heavy-handedness in any movie. That's just how I am. Like, to me, it's just like, okay, I don't need a 2.5 to 5 minute monologue about something that like you've established in this movie. It's lazy. Mm-hmm. And it's honestly treating the audience as stupid, in my opinion, which always frustrates me.
And the thing is, we know both Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach can do that so tastefully. And they can do it so skillfully because we've seen it.
We saw Marriage Story.
Yeah. Right. Like we've seen it from them before. I will say, I think another thing that made it so that this movie was a little disappointing to me, the opening sequence to this movie is hilarious.
What is the opening sequence to this movie?
The 2001 parody.
Oh, yeah. The 2001 parody was fantastic. Where they're just smashing the babies. That was great.
And like to think about like, that's how I feel like one of the deeper parts of this movie where it's like they're taking the Dawn of Man sequence to be like this dawn of women. It's so clever. And it set the bar too high for me.
It did. That's a very good point. I agree with that. Jordan is, I think, has summed up what we said. Comedy is really specific to the consumer. I thought the movie was very funny, but heavy handed at times. I agree.
Yeah.
But yes, that 2001, I couldn't believe that that's where it was going. And that the monolith is Barbie. Like that's just fantastic. And all the kids, all the little girls are smashing the baby dolls and they're just shattering. Like that stuff's great. Like I'm all about that. I'm all about that. But that, again, that's kind of more subtle, right? Cause my wife had no idea what that reference was to because she's never seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, but they didn't have to spell that movie out
a couple of months ago.
She didn't watch it. She wouldn't watch it, but they didn't have to spell out. This is a joke from 2001 A Space Odyssey for it to be funny. Like it's funny no matter what. Well, like, it's funny no matter what.
Even like there's that moment where, you know, the film calls you and I out, Phil, where they're talking about like, you know, just tell him you've never seen The Godfather and he needs to explain it to you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. I didn't appreciate it, but it was funny.
Yeah. No, and that's the type of stuff, like, again, that's a great part. And that all comes after that monologue. And all of these little things could have just summed up to that monologue. We didn't need the monologue on top of that. Like it's what the Lil Dicky song, the rapper where he does the song of like, I'm just glad, like I'm not scared to watch good movies. And it's like his wife hiding her face when he pulls out the Schindler's List box. Like it's just like, I don't know. Like it's funny. It's a stereotype that like men like movies and women don't, and men have to explain the movie to women. That's fun. And I feel like those moments are great in this movie. Those little ones, those subtle ones, like all of that. The part where they're singing Push by Matchbox 20 over and over again. Yeah. And then the girls just start getting up and walking away from them. And it throws the men into such a tizzy because they're not getting the attention that they need. That's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And it's not subtle, but it's also not so heavy handed.
Yeah.
And it's that balance that some of the movie just does not have.
Yeah. Like overall, like this is a good movie. It's a fun mm-hmm. movie. It's a good watch. I recommend people watch it. I don't know how often I would revisit it, but I'm glad I watched it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And there was something I was going to say, but it's totally gone now, so it doesn't matter. I'll end with this because obviously as we watch these movies, it's going to be a topic of discussion and all that. I think that ultimately Barbie will end up with Ryan Gosling's going to get nominated. Mm-hmm. I think production design is a no doubter. I think costume design is a no doubter. And I think there's a chance, depending on how the rest of the year goes, because with the writer strike and things getting pushed around and everything like that, we'll see how the rest of the year goes. I think they may throw something in for Greta Gerwig to get either a writing or a directing nomination. Directing, I wouldn't be mad about. Writing, she does not deserve it. Like, it's not there. She's sharper and everything else she's done. Same thing with Bumball. Yeah. Like, I love Bumball. It's not there. It shouldn't get it, but I could see it happening. But I think for sure you're going to get costume design. I'm Just Ken. All of that stuff's going to happen. So I think it's going to end up with like 4 or 5 Oscar nominations. If it ends up getting a Best Picture nomination, I might have to lower my rating to like 1.5.
I could see it getting it if they decide to go 10. I mean, again, totally
it is 10, right?
Dependent at this point. Well, last year was 8, right?
But I think it's automatically 10 now moving forward. I think they changed that when they
right. Yeah. And like, if this is the movie that like saved movie theaters, I could see it getting the nom.
Yeah. I mean, also the storyline, let's say the writer strike is just ending, the actor strike is just ending, coming up towards Oscar season. And if the storyline going into Oscars night is Barbenheimer again, the movie industry wins. The movie industry wins if it's Barbie versus Oppenheimer. And I know there's going to be other really good movies that are going to come out, and we got Scorsese and stuff like that coming out further down the line. But I think the movie industry wins if it's Barbenheimer again on that night. And what I love about these two movies, and then I will end this so I can go, you know, it's only 9:30. I can't even make the argument if I got to go to bed like I used to. But I will say this. This movie, and Oppenheimer's doing it as well, and we'll talk, Oppenheimer's going to be next week. These movies showed that you can make, and I know Barbie's based on something and Oppenheimer's based on a true story, that you can make original content and people will go see.
So important. So important. Huge. And I think it's really, I mean, even if we just look at like Bob Iger's comments about like Star Wars and the MCU with all of this strike stuff going on and everything, and saying that like they messed up, they did too many movies. He talks about how they kind of ruined Pixar by doing straight to streaming and everything.
Oh, yeah.
I think the studios are starting to realize they need to go back to these original ideas. And this weekend just puts it over the top.
It really does. And I think we're about to see. I think we're about to see a change, because a lot of these studios aren't going to be able to afford to make these gigantic blockbusters now coming off of this strike. They're going to get hit and they're going to lose money and they're going to need to figure out new ways. And maybe we're going to get some good creativity, because remember,
we still get A24 movies, so we're fine.
I know, but you say that like a religion, John. I agree. I know we're still going to get some movies, but you have to remember, A24, the writers are on strike for everybody.
I know.
The actors might not be on strike for A24, but the writers are on strike for everybody.
Yeah.
So A24 movies most of the time are good writing and good acting. Well, if you're missing half of that, then A24 movies aren't going to be good either. So that's the biggest thing. Like, they got to come to a conclusion on this. But I really do believe, like, they have really, really, really butchered this industry right now. And Barbie and Oppenheimer are showing a path out. And you don't need to just keep making these tent poles. Go make indie movies. Make movies that are going to make people think and that people are going to like get emotional about. Because back in the day, these indie type movies used to be box office hits too. We're not that far removed from that happening. We're really not. And I think we're getting there again. And I think we're getting there again. And I think we're getting there again. And we'll see how the rest of the summer goes. But it was very nice to see a weekend with Christopher Nolan and with Greta Gerwig be the biggest weekend ever. That was great. I love that.
Yeah, it's fantastic because this isn't an IP driving a movie. Like, I mean, it is for Barbie, but like this is us returning to a point where people are excited for people making movies.
Yep.
And the people who are making them, the reason why Barbie was so big, yes, it was super big, but we saw all the memes leading up to it about like the film bros all wanting to go see Barbie. That's because of who is attached to it.
Yeah.
Like we are at a point where names are bringing people in again. We've been at a point where movie stars haven't been a thing. We might be going back to movie stars being enough to bring people into movies again.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, Ryan Gosling did that for the guys coming out to see it. Barbie. I couldn't wait to watch Ryan Gosling be in a movie again. And I skipped The Gray Man because screw Netflix. But I totally agree. And again, like going back to like the Oscar argument, because the Oscars are always trying to figure out new ways to pretty much ruin themselves, but also like get more viewers and stuff. And at the end of the day, what the Oscar viewers are going to be cinephiles. If you start tuning out the cinephiles to try to get the mass audience, you're not going to get the cinephiles and you're not going to get the mass audience. But Barbie and Oppenheimer, the difference here with these are your Black Panther, Avengers, Captain America type things without being those. It's not being forced of, we need to nominate Angela Bassett. No, you don't need to. Like, it's going to naturally come if you make damn movies that are good. And I think like Barbie and Oppenheimer are showing that like, just make the movies. Not everything has to be weird like Wes Anderson stuff. It can be very normal, straightforward stuff. But it also doesn't need to go the complete opposite direction where we just need to start nominating superhero movies as if they're the greatest things ever made. Mm-hmm. There's a balance. Do I think Barbie should be in a Best Picture conversation? No, not really any year I've ever been alive. But if it is, I'm more okay with that because it just doesn't feel as forced. It feels like something that was naturally conceived and made. And it's going to lead to other movies that are going to be good, whether those are coming from Greta Gerwig, people who are inspired by the movie, Margot Robbie movies that we're going to get now because this movie was made, Ryan Gosling being back, Simu Liu becoming a star right before everybody's eyes, as we all know. Great. I'm all about it. And now I'm off my soapbox.
I think this marks a really good thing because like we're in a year with a lot of high-profile movies that are coming out. And I'm hoping as I was just glancing at the weeks to come and what we can talk about on the podcast, we have some good ones to talk about, and I'm hoping this is just the start of this revitalization before this strike takes us out of a little bit.
Yeah, I know. Enjoy it now, kids, because it's going to be a long haul come 2024. So anyway, this was fun. I'm glad we did this. So next week, we're jumping into The Incredible Hulk, the one with Ed Norton. We're only doing, so to just establish this even further, we're only doing ones that are definitely classified in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So like we're not doing the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans. We're not doing Deadpool. We're not going to do that. We're not, even though when Deadpool 3 comes out or whatever, we might just go back and watch the first two Deadpools. We might go back and watch them just so that like we can say like whatever. So we'll figure that out as we actually get there. But we're only doing movies that are actually in like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We're not going out and doing the Eric Bonick Hulk because...
Oh, Ang Lee's Hulk, though. Like, we can't...
Yikes. Anyway, so that's what we're doing. So we're going to go in order. So it'll be The Incredible Hulk next week, and we're going to be talking Oppenheimer. So we're a week late on Oppenheimer, but we correctly made the decision to do Barbie first, which we made that decision way back because we knew it was going to be a bigger hit. It almost doubled up Oppenheimer at the box office, but yet Oppenheimer still had a great box office, especially for an R-rated movie. That's the big takeaway from that.
For an R-rated movie on a weekend where another massive movie was coming out. The fact that people were going out to both of these movies this weekend tells you how important this weekend was.
Yeah, it was huge. So if you love movies, keep watching. Share us on things. Also, follow us on Letterboxd. I'm PWood43. John's J. Millsip. I just became a patron on Letterboxd. And it's so much nicer because now I don't have the ads exploding all over my screen all the time. So follow some of my lists. I've been doing a lot of watching of things, over this summer and since we finished. So go follow us on that. And, that's it. That's all I got. We'll be back. Are we doing next Monday? What is our date? Sure. Do you have a date?
We can do that
next month. All right. We're doing next Monday night again, probably around the same time, as long as it doesn't rain in the Vancouver area and John knows how to get home. So
yeah,
we'll see y'all next week.